Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thanks for listening.
All right. With that, we're going to move on to proposals, number 10. Tom, you heading this one up too? We're not giving, you getting overtime this week or? I haven't heard anything from Simpson and you're doing all the talking.
I asked Director Simpson if he wanted to take these on today and he said, no, thank you.
He's like a free agent. I mean, you assign stuff to him as needed and this wasn't one of them, huh?
I guess not. So Mr. Chairman, I am going to ask Andrew Norton to come up. Andrew is our wildlife program administrator and he's going to provide you an information item that's listed on your agenda again to provide a little bit of background on this issue, and then he will take the lead on going through the action sheets. We know there's obviously high interest, as we heard from the open forum today and several emails and text messages that all of you have received on this topic. And we do appreciate all the input on this. We know this is very meaningful, impactful, and something that is of high interest to a lot of folks. And we certainly understand that and appreciate that. We've gone through a lot of steps and processes that have been talked about already, from petitions in the past to conversations at commission meetings to doing a public input opportunity this fall, a stakeholder group meeting, and just one-on-one conversations with people. Lots of ideas, lots of recommendations have come forward. You are all familiar already what's in front of you, and in particular some of the recommended ideas or suggestions from the public as well. But I think it's also important to point out that honestly, folks, we're at the beginning of this conversation as well. We went through a lot of the phase of collecting ideas, information. We put together several ideas. We brought forward a recommendation based on a lot of those ideas and conversations that took place. And so this is the starting point of that conversation. So I'm going to ask Andrew to come up, give you a brief PowerPoint on some background information, and then we can go into your action sheets and take the conversation from there.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Chair Olson, Secretary Roebling. As Tom mentioned, I'm Andrew Norton and Wildlife Program Administrator, and I'm here this afternoon to follow up on a presentation that I provided 2 months ago, I believe, on this topic. So I'll have a little bit of summary first, and then I'll get into specifics of the proposal. So the background, this is again just review. As you're well aware, the number of bow hunters in the state has steadily been increasing the last 10 years. That seems to somewhat buck the trend in population growth of deer. You can see there from 2005 to 2010, bow hunters more followed what we had with deer trends, a steep increase through the 2000s and then a steep decrease. But since bow hunters steadily increased, you can see the figure on the left there. This has been more evident with antelope hunters. They've doubled in the last 10 years, whereas deer hunters have increased by 30%. The green line shows residents, the blue line shows non-residents. So both groups have been increasing at approximately the same rate. Both groups are currently unlimited. The red dots, just for reference, show the archery harvest the last 10 years as well, and you can see that's steadily been increasing, somewhat contrary to what deer populations have been doing. So essentially, archery hunter success has stayed relatively stable in 10 years, but hunters have increased. The crux of this issue, as you're well aware and have heard several times, is that there seems to be some primary concerns on public land, and I know a question came up last time about hunter densities on public versus private. There's about 6 times as many antelope hunters on public compared to private, and there's about 5 times as many deer hunters on public compared to private. So this isn't just a perceived issue. This is probably real, where we see a lot more hunters on public, which isn't news to anyone. I also want to start by saying this is more of an issue of a crowding. I hate to use the word social versus biological, but it truly is social. There certainly is biology involved with bucks being harvested, but what this really is it's a perceived competition with other hunters and who gets an opportunity to harvest bucks. With that being said, we did isolate this discussion to just archery. A lot of comments came in regards to archery versus other seasons, firearm for instance. Fortunately, we have the opportunity later next year to bring deer recommendations in March, as well as a deer action plan. So we're going to have several stakeholder meetings and discuss archery in the context of other seasons a lot more. But for today, keeping this focused on just archery, kind of an isolated issue, and as Tom said, trying to just tip of the iceberg approach here, not rock the boat hopefully too much. Another thing I'll say is we've had lots of discussions about population management. Again, this being more of an issue related to buck harvest, this doesn't really have our recommendation doesn't have relation to population management. So when we're talking about low mule deer numbers or maybe even low whitetail numbers in certain areas or disparity in harvest of archers versus other seasons, this recommendation today doesn't address that. This is just going to be addressing the archery hunters, again, focusing on bucks. So we didn't look at, for example, antlerless harvest of archery. This was, again, just focused at hunter density on public land specifically, as you'll see with our recommendation. So I'll really briefly go through this. A lot of the comments today summarized this fairly succinctly. You can clearly see that there's opinions on both sides of the fence here. We sent a questionnaire out to all hunters, so they had an opportunity to provide input, hunters from the past 3 years. Some would say the survey results weren't very reliable because they were low response rate, but more importantly, what that says is this is an isolated issue, so it's not pervasive across all hunters. Only about 10% on average responded. I will say, however, some might question the statistical integrity of the survey. It's not that far off because we were able to almost exactly estimate the number of archery hunters on public land, because we have that for deer because they have to buy a license, before April 1st. We were within 1.5% of that estimate. So while some may question the merits of the survey, I do feel that it provided a pretty good perspective of, if you will, opinionated hunters. We followed up the questionnaire with a stakeholder meeting. They were generally in agreement with much of what the survey said. Again, we read through the thousands of comments, and we know that opinions vary across the board, as you heard today as well. But in general, this was an issue primarily related to hunters on public land, and specifically the residents were concerned that there were too many non-residents. We had multiple Game Fish and Parks staff meetings to develop a list of options. That was a challenge even internally. We had about 8 options that we whittled it down to, but before that we probably had dozens of recommendations. So I want to go through just a summary of the options that we came with. There was 2 general categories. One was to limit the number of hunters just generally across the entire state. The other was to limit hunters by area. One thing to keep in mind, again, circling back to what Director Kirschman said, was we're trying to treat this somewhat as a tip of the iceberg, maybe first step. One challenge we have, especially with deer, is our regulations are extremely complex. They're sometimes hard for staff to even understand. So while we could treat this with the scalpel and come in with extremely complex regulations, we wanted to take a first approach of seeing baby steps, again, if you will, to try to provide a recommendation that might start to address some of the concerns. So options to limit hunters just statewide more generally. Obviously, we could just put a cap on total numbers across the entire state. You'll see a nuance of that in the proposal is that we wanted to also provide unlimited opportunity on private land, because we essentially heard very, very limited complaints or justification for limiting hunters on private land. As you saw in that first slide, there was over 5 times as many hunters on public land. Private landowners are able to self-regulate the number of hunters on their property. Another option, again, this added a little bit of complexity, and you can see it didn't come into favor with the recommendation we have today, was to focus just exclusively on mule deer. That would be to limit the number of archery hunters, but then provide an unlimited number of any deer licenses on private land, but in addition provide an unlimited number of any whitetail licenses. So essentially what we would be doing by default is limiting the ability to harvest a mule deer buck. Again, a lot of these proposals today don't address population management. It's just strictly hunter crowding and buck harvest. Some other options, this is maybe more of a scalpel approach, would be to add limited access units. One thing we heard with internal staff discussions, comments from the questionnaire, in addition to the stakeholder survey, was we could add limited access units, but that might just shift the problem. We did that 3 years ago in Unit 35L, Custer National Forest. It has provided some benefit up there, but it may just shift hunters onto other public land in Harding County, Perkins County, up in northwestern South Dakota. Another option is to move to more of a unit or regional approach and divvy those hunters out spatially. This is certainly an option, but again, goes down the path of adding a lot more complexity. So you can imagine, in looking at the proposals, kind of what we arrived on. I won't repeat myself here, but we wanted to minimize complexity. We wanted to be consistent between antelope and deer to again, try to make things as easy to understand so we're not completely different with what we do with the two different species. So we obviously have a lot more resident hunters than we have non-residents, so the proposals you'll see today that we have a recommendation for you to approve are no change to resident archery, and so the restrictions would just be based on non-residents. That would be to eliminate the East River, West River archery licenses, and then to put a cap on non-residents on public land at 25% below what we think are the current numbers right now. You can see, how did we get to that 25% below? We know how many hunters purchased a license that was valid on public, but that doesn't necessarily mean they hunted a lot on public. So what we wanted to do based on that survey, again, I said it was pretty accurate within 1.5% of the actual number that exclusively hunted public. We wanted to take the number of hunters that said they hunted 50% or more on public. So you can see in the second column there, 54% of deer hunters, 69% of antelope hunters hunted 50% or more on public. We could multiply that by the total number of hunters to get that third column, our estimate of those number of hunters based on the 2021 license sales. This is unique deer hunters, by the way. And then the percent cut, approximately 25%. That's why we arrived on the 2,200, 450. Obviously, one of the comments was this isn't quite the 8%, wherever that may have come from, but it also isn't 25%, which we have on Custer National Forest, of the number of non-residents relative to residents, and that's exclusively public, so that could be another way to look at this. With that, I can take any questions on this, and then I can bring the action items as well.
Sure, Commissioner Risler.
The antelope numbers, I want to go back a couple of months ago. The GFMP team came to us and talked to us about concerns with antelope because of the drought and predators. And does this number reflect any of that at all?
No, maybe I gleaned over it with these proposals today are isolated to just looking at hunter density and crowding and more of a social issue. If you remember back to the antelope recommendations and finalizations that were approved, can't quite remember, June or July, July this year, they eliminated any antlerless, or not antlerless, but female harvest on the archery license for antelope. So we've already removed that for antelope.
Yes, I do remember that.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Chairman, is there any outlook on public lands that were slowed down, I mean, shut off from mentors killing mule deer? Is that somewhere in the proposal at all to limit archery hunters from not killing mule deer does?
Through the chair. Again, we looked at this concern based almost exclusively from the petition where it was a crowding issue. We didn't look at a population level management. We certainly could do that, or it's obviously the commission's prerogative to do that now, but we will be bringing archery deer in March, as well as the deer action plan, where we'll have several stakeholder meetings, and we can vet that a lot more options to reduce antlerless mule deer harvest, whether that be through eliminating doe harvest on archery licenses. There's obviously still type 01 firearm licenses where there's the majority of antlerless mule deer harvest that occurs. And there's several other landowner licenses and other options to reduce and or eliminate mule deer doe harvest.
Mr. Chairman, and again, Commissioner Spring, in respect to archery deer season, Remember that all antlerless deer licenses for archery are whitetail only. So that holds true for archery deer hunting, muzzleloader deer hunting. Antlerless licenses are whitetail only.
And you mentioned 35L, and I remember when we worked with the South Dakota bow hunters and other sporting groups to put on the constraints of that to help lessen that burden of a non-resident pressure, and we even gave residents like an early crack at it. And to be proof in the pudding, after we did that, I mean, I applied for and got the access permit, went out there, spent 3 days in the rain, and moved on. I mean, it's beautiful country, but if it rains for 3 days and you're a resident, you can go home. If you're a non-resident, you come to hunt for 10 days, you're sticking it out. And I would argue that's probably, when Dane and I have had this conversation, that's why they have a higher success rate. They didn't come there so that they would have to go pick up kids from school. They don't have to go to somebody's birthday party. They're there for that group of period to do one thing, and that's hunt. And so I think that the thing about those guys having a higher success rate, I think probably doesn't matter if you're in Colorado, if you go to Alaska, if you go to Wyoming, you're there for one thing, and that's just to hunt. And so your non-residents probably do have a higher success rate. But the one thing that we keep coming back to, and we kind of bounce around on it, and I think that we could have got it there, because I know, you know, we're in a non-motorized unit, and there's people driving out there. Same said, if you needed the access permit like I had to have, and you don't have it, you know, what's our incident for finding people that are in there that they're supposed to have the access permit compared to what the fine is? And does that weigh in on their decisions? And or should we be considering upping the fee for someone that has a private land only tag that we catch on public land that knowingly, and again, it goes back to knowing, but I mean, you know that they know the difference between public land and private land. And if they're on their hunting, why aren't we having that conversation of making that sting a little bit more than it does now? And I'm fully in favor of hitting somebody in the wallet. In non-residents, we do it to them all the time. You're coming all the way out here. If you knowingly do that, wham, it should hurt. And so while we're having this conversation, I want to just see if you guys talked about that internally or not, because I'd like to see that hurt. You know, $120, believe me, if you're coming here from another state, $120 at the end of the day, you go, well, all right, if I can get in there, get a big buck, not get caught, I'll pay the $120.
Mr. Chairman, and I am going to ask Chief Sam Scalehouse to help answer these questions from a law enforcement perspective, because those are the folks that deal with those circumstances and situations. I would believe in the grand scheme of things, somebody that has a private land license, by and large, and for the most part, is going to be respectful of that and following the rules and guidelines of a private land license. And are there bad apples out there that will see something and temptation gets the best of them? I have no doubt that there is, correct? We know that those things happen. So I would ask Chief Scalehouse to please chime in here, and he can maybe answer a little bit more of, number one, how often do we see that or deal with it? Is it more frequent than we believe, or is it not? And in respect to the fines themselves, again, I would have Mr. Katilnik chime in here. As we have these rules in it, or these guidelines and regulations in administrative rule, as they fall within administrative rule, those fines are set based on a class two. Now, if there's certain fines that would want to be higher based on circumstances, then I believe that those actions would have to take more legislative or statute action. Kind of like we had conversations about increasing the fees for like a second knowing trespass, and we've had those conversations before to make that sting a little bit more, if I may, using your analogy there. So, Sam, if you're still on the phone, could you please provide some information to the commissioners on frequency or issues around people with a private land license, for example, or a non-access permit hunting in an area that requires an access permit?
Yes. Good afternoon, Commission. My name is Sam Scott, law enforcement chief for the Game Fish and Park. Just to clarify, could you make sure I'm on the right track here? You're looking at the folks with archery licenses that are private land only, or vice versa, that are violating that. Is that my track correct?
That's correct, Sam. Or, for example, somebody that does not have an access permit for 35L, for example, and then is going in there and hunting. How frequent are those infractions happening, or or do our officers deal with those situations?
Yeah, Tom, pretty infrequent, and they do happen. I know I've had a few in my time when I was in the field, you know, particularly with a CHAP area or something like that, control hunting access, where there's a special access permit needed. I know they have come across them in places very infrequently in like Adams Nature Area or Goodhart State Park, where those access permits are there. But I have not heard of any of our officers having issues with this out in Western South Dakota. Did that answer the question?
It does, Sam. I'm surprised, to be honest with you, that we don't see more of that, because they are bad apples, and we're going to have that no matter what we do today, tomorrow, or 10 months from now on this or any other issues. We can't prevent bad apples just because, you know, that's just, it's in their element. They weren't brought up the same way the rest of us were, you know. So I appreciate you weighing in on that. And maybe, Sam, while we got you there one more time, too, the difference in our ability today to potentially amend or make changes to this between now and some type of finalization on these, where the fee structure for doing that is concerned, are we do we have our hands tied, as Tom may have concerns with, or do we have the authority to make changes there and add a higher fine for these incidences?
Yeah, when it comes, Mr. Chairman, when it comes to some of the ARSDs that Tom was referring to, they're the Class 2 misdemeanors, and most of those are laid out in a fine and bond schedule that gets put out every year. And so at this point in time right now, we're I think there's a potential to amend if needed. I've never done that, and I would work with Mr. Katilnik to look into that more. But otherwise, it's, you know, every year in March, we make recommendations to the committee that looks at the fine and bond schedule, and then July 1 is when the new one starts.
Yeah, well, thanks again, Sam. And while we got him here with the mic in his hand, he was the next guy I was going to go to if we didn't have the right answers. We got to make sure that John's getting the per diem here today. So go ahead, John, if you wouldn't mind trying to answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, John Katilnik, staff attorney. I heard a couple questions and conversations about, you know, the fine amount and whether it's enough to act as a deterrent. And these aren't unsimilar conversations that we've had even recently with AIS and boat plugs and things like that. Unfortunately, most of the general public doesn't have a knowledge of how much a fine is, right? So you could increase it to $1,000 and it still might not deter people because they don't know what the fine is until they actually do it. So that's just one thing to consider about that bond schedule. To Sam's point, the class two versus class one misdemeanors, the class one, and Sam, feel free to correct me at any point, but the class one misdemeanors it's depending on how the officers write the ticket. There may be ways for them to write a class one misdemeanor for a violation of taking a game, let's say, and again, I'm speaking totally off the cuff, taking big game without the proper license, and that could potentially be a violation of statute, which it would be a class one misdemeanor, which would include higher fines, and which would cause the person to lose their hunting privileges for a year. And honestly, again, Sam can correct me, that's probably a bigger deterrent than any fine imposed, is if a hunter loses their hunting privileges or fishing privileges for a year. So those are some of the things to consider, and we can certainly explore, you know, some of those deterring effects, but, you know, I might work with Sam a little bit more in the coming month or so to figure out if there is a way under our current system to potentially write those tickets in a manner that would address the deterrent factor.
Yeah, thanks, Jen. And that's the good news. Today isn't the last step on the ladder for this process, and the fact that we're having the conversation is a win for South Dakota bow hunters, and quite frankly, I think the Landowners Alliance folks too. I mean, this if we're pushing people off public land, they may have to be contacting some of Mr. Bell's clients to get onto their land to hunt. So I'm kind of hoping that we're at a win-win. And we worked, this thing was dead. I mean, the South Dakota bow hunters brought their ideas forward. It died, and that's where it could have stayed on the shelf. We, out of mutual respect for the relationships that we built over the years, said that we would bring something forward. You have, this is 100% more than nothing, and that's what we started with. And I think it is a step in the right direction when we start to talk about public lands being available to our citizens of South Dakota first, and then other folks. We don't want to deter people from coming here, and I don't think these are deterrents. It just makes you think a little more clearly when you're mapping out your plans to come to our state. And I would, I'd really like to see you guys work, John, on something different on the fee schedule. Maybe it even goes into the notice thing, Chris, and anybody in the licensing. When they get their note, their thing is the big pink ticket says, hey, by the way, this is for private land only. You step over the line, it's $500. And that way they can't say, well, I didn't know. Well, then you know. I mean, if you can afford it, go for it, you know. But, you know, I really do appreciate the staff. I appreciate Dana and his group for the work that's went into this. I think that we're moving in the right direction. We're not done, but again, today, with all the work that's been done, we're moving in the right direction. This isn't the end of the process. It's the very beginning of a great conversation. So appreciate everybody that's been involved thus far. And with that, I think we can go on to, if anybody has any questions or thoughts before we move on.